This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you tune the dial to your local country music station these days, you might also hear political commentary set to twanging guitars and pounding pianos. Today's popular country music features a largely pro-conservative tone. Country music historian Bill Malone joins us now from the studios of WHA in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here.
Now, country music didn't start out as being generally conservative, did it?
Well, it was always socially conservative. That is, there was a resistance to new fashions and trends or a suspicion of them. But as far as politics is concerned, they were all over the board. This music inherited a strong populistic tradition from the 1880s and 90s, and a lot of that showed up in the music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could find songs that railed against banks and against big business and against rich people. And in fact, Charlie Oakes, who recorded in 1925, he recorded an obituary for William Jennings Bryan. And he said Bryan was a hero, but had never been elected to office because, quote, capitalist wouldn't let him win.
Hmm.
And so that's kind of an unusual. That goes against the grain of what we consider country music to be today.
And you, of course, think of, Mr. Guthrie is an outstanding example, but a lot of bluegrass material came out of the mountain states, where a lot of the issues were big coal companies and union.
And textile mills. Some of the greatest songs in country music are the songs that come in on the conditions in the textile mills, the stretch-out system and the low pay and the use of child labor. Songs like Serves 'Em Fine and Cotton Mill Colic and so on. And you're right about the coal mining songs. Also a lot of agricultural songs that spoke out against cotton tenantry, like the song Down on Penny's Farm. And there was a very popular song in the 1920s called 11-Cent Cotton and 40-Cent Meat, which talked about the predicament of farmers. So there's a lot of good social comment and topicality that came out in this early music.
Well, we have an example from that era. Let's listen to Slim Smith, and this is the Breadline Blues from 1932.
The latest news has struck me funny. Said you have no friends if you haven't got money. All of us good folks in distress, but I'm gonna get something off of my chest. 1932 won't be long, and when you place your vote, please don't vote wrong. Vote away those blues, the Breadline Blues.
Again, Slim Smith from 1932, coming out, a pretty obvious endorsement there.
Yeah, very much so, and Billy Cox later on wrote a song called NRA Blues and talked about how the National Recovery Administration would raise the wages of workers and reduce the hours of work that they had to do. And then in 1936, when Roosevelt was elected a second time, he wrote a very glowing song called Franklin D. Roosevelt's Back Again.
Mm-hmm.
He was very glad to see that man in the White House.
Now, most of us, associate country music with a couple of different things. I mean, a lot of it's apolitical, empty bottle, broken heart, and you're still on my mind,
right?
Kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff. Yeah. But I think the there was a reaction in a lot of ways to, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Well, what we might call reaction really started in the 1950s during the Cold War, and when we learned that the Soviet Union had the atomic bomb, and when there seemed to be a disintegration of morals in the country, a lot of the concern about that began to show up in religious songs, many of which spoke as if they thought that the end of the world was near and people had to change in time. Those songs usually didn't take political expression. I can remember one song that did. Grandpa Jones had a song called I'm No Communist, which reflected the concern over the Reds at that time.
Mm-hmm. I remember when Castro threw her out and I took her in.
You find the seeds of the modern day political conservatism in the late 1960s when Merle Haggard and people like that began to protest against the protesters.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
a
the classic song,
song
of that genre is Okie from Muskogee.
And we have that. Here's Merle Haggard from 1969.
And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee. A place where even squares can have a ball.
We still wave old glory down at the courthouse.
And white lightning's still the biggest thrill of all.
course, one of the ironies of Okie from Muskogee is we've learned many years subsequent to its release and its embracement as a conservative anthem that the moment the song was written, Mr. Haggard was on a great deal more than White Lightning.
Right. That song started out as a joke. They were just driving through Oklahoma, and they saw the Muskogee city limit sign, and somebody in the band said, "Boy, I bet they don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee." So they laughed about it and sat down and wrote the song. And to Haggard's great surprise and delight, it became a huge hit, and he got standing ovations wherever he appeared in the United States, north and south. And so he got the reputation, which he's really tried to slough off in later years, of being the voice of the silent majority. He's a much more complicated man than that. He's written some very sensitive songs, for example, about Okies and about working people in general.
And as you say, some sensitive songs, but there's a definite populist strain to people like Merle Haggard.
Yeah, that's the idea that the people are supreme and that generally they can work out their own solutions. And most solutions are simple, but when they get in a pinch, like during the Great Depression or other times too, they fall back on government support. A real crucial aspect of 1890s populism was the belief that the government can work behalf on the people. And so you had great support for William Jennings Bryan in the South and for Tom Watson and other people who supported that kind of active government agenda.
And now, that kind of thing, that's kind of hard to find. As more and more country music became, established in Nashville and more established there, you tune in on country radio these days, and it sounds like a conservative anthem every minute.
Right, and it's really kind of ironic and really out of character for this music to be such an establishment art form, because after all, it came out of a region whose people at one time fought four bloody years against the national government, and Charlie Daniels can talk about his reverence for the flag, but his ancestors and mine fought against that flag between 1861 and 65, and if they'd succeeded, the United States would have been a much different place. And so I think country musicians are forgetting their individualistic past and the fact that there has long been a strong strain of dissent and outright opposition to the status quo and to the establishment in this music, viewed historically.
Get a caller on the line. Ryan joins us from Traverse City, Michigan.
Hi, Ryan. Just wanted to ask, what effect does the speaker think about the pro-America anthems that have come out, like Toby Keith, Put a Boot in Your Ass? Mm-hmm. What that effect has on public discourse, and does this reinforce the idea that anti-war automatically means anti-America?
I think to many people it has exactly that effect, that America should act without thinking and act decisively and let the politicians talk, and good Americans are going out there and looking for a quick and overwhelming solution. I really think it reinforces that attitude.
Well, isn't it some of it based also on the idea of supporting the troops?
Yeah, it's, of course, that's rather vague assertion. You have to ask, what do you mean by supporting the troops? Do you mean by throwing them into situations where they're...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think
have proper equipment or out in harm's way, and does that translate into support for the government that sends them there too? It's really a much more complex thing than that.
I do understand, but there's mm-hmm. also getting back to that reaction to the '60s, the idea that a lot of people felt when they came back from Vietnam, the soldiers, that they were despised and spat upon, and this is we're not going to do that again. A lot of those soldiers came from the South and West.
Yeah, that helps to explain a lot of it, the fact that so many boys and girls have come from working-class families in the South, and the South has always had this reputation, at least since the Civil War, of being a very patriotic region. And it's true that servicemen were often attacked for their government's sins, for their government's mistakes. Mm-hmm. That certainly happened after Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
Ryan, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We're talking with country music historian Bill Malone. He's the author of Country Music USA, just re-released a couple of years ago. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Jeff. Jeff's calling from East Lansing in Michigan.
Yes. What do you think the the effect of the civil rights movement, especially the early part of it, the southern-based part of it, what effect did that have on country music going conservative?
It had a strong effect. I think the music followed the direction of the region which first gave it birth. And this music, in the beginning, was a southern working-class expression. And I think the Civil Rights Revolution and all the other social revolutions of the 50s, the Women's Revolution and the Youth Revolution, they all changed society and they threatened masculine dominance in the region. A lot of these songs you hear today, these very jingoistic songs, I think come out of masculine insecurity. And it's true, the Civil Rights Revolution did a lot to change attitudes in the South and to move the region away from its allegiance to the Democratic Party. And regrettably, there were a rather large number of segregationist songs that appeared in the late 50s. Most of them were sold under the counter and sold surreptitiously, but they painted a very ugly picture of race relations in the South and in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Thanks, Jeff. And let's talk also with John. John's calling from Florence, South Carolina.
Hi, I'm familiar with the tradition of like protest and country music from before the Second World War in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. My question today about modern country music, do these singers or songwriters actually write this stuff to instill some type of reaction in people, or do they know that they're writing to an audience that's fairly responsive, and they just do it to increase, you know, multi-million dollar sales, like, hey, yeah, I agree with this guy, let's buy his or her record?
I think in part that's the motivation. I referred to Merle Haggard earlier. You know, he stumbled on Okie from Muskogee, but when he found out that there was a mass audience out there that liked to hear that music and its sentiments, then he explicitly wrote The Fat Inside of Me, which was designed to appeal to that audience. And so, yes, I think there are a lot of musicians today, I think, who feel that they're speaking to a large constituency, so they're giving them what they think they want to hear. But on the other hand, I don't think there's any reason to think that a lot of this feeling is heartfelt. Toby Keith, they say, is a Democrat, so I don't know how he's voting this year. But I think he reacted strong. Yeah, he reacted strongly to 9/11. You know, I guess a lot of Americans feel, well, we don't know who the enemy is, and so let's go out and hit somebody, even if it's Iraq.
And that's what prompted my question, excuse me, the boot in the ass. Did he write this because he feels we should do this, or because... Yeah, that's probably why a lot of the people who are country music Western audience feel. Let's just, you know, give them a boot in the ass.
I guess it'd be impossible to say. If there's probably a little bit of both. I think he knows his audience, but at the same time, it's probably a true expression of his feeling. You know, Hank Williams Jr. expresses those ideas too, and I think he's not really necessarily looking for a big audience because Hank is not on the top 40 anymore. He's like most of the old timers. He's sort of pushed to the side.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It is not, of course, a monolith that all country performers are conservatives. Here's an example. Tony Stampley singing Taking My Country Back from 2004.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them. Now we owe billions to the Red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
So as we're continuing with Bill Malone, we just have a few seconds left, Bill, but there is another side to this.
Yeah, that's dyed-in-the-wool country. Tony is the son of Joe Stample, who was a country rocker back in the 60s. And that song was written by... I'm drawing a blank now. David Kent, a songwriter in Nashville. And it's put out by a group called Honky Tonkers for Truth, and they're trying to say that there is another voice, that country music should not be put in one cubbyhole, and that it belongs to everybody. And so there's an organization now in Nashville called Music Row Democrats, which is really fighting for John Kerry and to do as much as they can for the ticket.
Bill Malone, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bill Malone's second edition, Country Music USA, was released in 2002. He was with us from the studios of WHA in Madison, Wisconsin. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.